You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Answer this question for me. What does God command more than anything else in the whole Bible? The most times. What does he command us the more times than anything else? To worship only God, to lay down idols. Those are the things that come to my mind. But actually 360 times, and actually more than that, more than 360 times, we see this command, do not be afraid. Why is that? Why more than anything else does God tell us, do not be afraid? Well, fear is a universal human experience that we're all experiencing, even today we've experienced it. And it drives so much of our life. It undergirds so much of what we do, whether we acknowledge it or not. Sigmund Freud, a famous psychologist, he referred to fear as the holy grail of the soul. Sounds kind of important. He wrote, there is no question that the problem of anxiety is a riddle whose solution would throw a flood of light on our whole mental existence. He's saying that if we could understand our fear and our anxiety, it would actually help us to understand all of humanity and what makes us tick, what makes us move. Our fears and our anxieties, they're a gateway to our heart, and they reveal what we truly love and what we think we need for life. This is the fourth week of our service on the life of David, and we've been walking through 1 Samuel to know and observe how David related to God. Well, today we're actually going to look at one of his psalms, because David wasn't just the king. He actually was a musician and a poet. And he wrote at least 70 of the 150 psalms that we have. And psalms are prayers or songs that are given to us to pray back to God. Donald Whitney says that they were birthed in the mind of God, and they were given to the people of God to pray back to him, to shape their will towards his. And so we're going to look at the scope of one psalm, a psalm that's about fear, and David experiencing fear. And my wife, Darby, and I, we have two boys. One's 3 and one's almost 5. And one of the more uncomfortable gifts, most of you parents know this, one of the more uncomfortable gifts of being a parent is the mirror, this brutal mirror that you look into every day. That watching them experience joy and struggle and go through life, you actually get to just see a window into your own heart. Like, oh my goodness, that's me. One example of this is just basically every day, our two boys, this is not some days, every day, at some point in the day, they put on a cape and a mask and they think that they are a superhero. During the light of day, they're like conquering everything. They're saving the world. But as soon as the light goes out, at the end of the day, they are incredibly needy. One night, my son Asher, our oldest, about a year ago, I remember I put him to bed, and it was actually, he literally didn't go the whole, he went the whole day with keeping his cape on. He literally had thought he was a superhero. But by the end of the day, I put him to bed, I leave him there, and I leave the room, and just 5 minutes later, he starts crying out and screaming, very unusual. And so I go in and see what's going on. And he's very defeated. After he finally calms down, he says, "Papa, I have plobrums." We don't have problems in our house. We have plobrums. I have plobrums. There are monsters in my closets. But that's me. This is me. I'm looking at me. During the light of the day, I think that I can conquer all kinds of things, all kinds of tasks. I'm saving the day. I'm providing for myself, consuming whatever I want, I'm fixing my own problems. But as soon as the light of day is turned off, as soon as I enter into a season of suffering or darkness or, I don't know, pain, everything starts to crumble and the monsters creep out of my closets. We have plobrums. Maybe I'm not good enough. Maybe I can't pay the rent this month. You're feeling the debt that you have. Maybe nobody wants you around, or you're feeling that. Well, David has actually come to such a revelation in Psalm 34. And in verse 6, he describes himself as a poor man crying out in need. David is a mighty warrior. He slays Goliath. He kills bears and lions. He's a mighty warrior. But at the end of the day, when he experiences darkness and isolation, he's just like us. He's afraid. Psalm 34 is a psalm that David wrote during this kind of a season, a time of anguish, a time of being overcome with fear. It's a didactic psalm, which means it's teaching us something. Most of the psalms are prayers that are given for us to pray back to God, but Psalm 34 is actually a teaching. He shares a testimony that God has done a work in his life and has given him an insight into how to deal with fear. So he instructs us. What do we do with our fear? What do we do with this problem of fear? So that we're going to talk about three things. The problem of fear, the solution to that fear, and how the solution actually works. How God has made it possible that solution works. So in order to understand that problem, the problem of fear, going back to the life of David, we're going to look at what's happened thus far in this story. So far in 1 Samuel, we've actually seen a whole bunch of fear in the life of David. We've seen the Israelites cowering to Goliath. David comes in, a little shepherd boy, and he kills a giant. And then he raises up in the ranks of the military, and he's loved by all the people. So much so that they started dancing and singing about him. Saul has killed his thousands, but David his 10,000s. Well, fear rises up in Saul. Anxiety rises up in Saul, and he thinks that David's going to take the throne from him. It's going to overtake him. But it's just this little song. It's speaking into his life, and it feeds his deep anxiety. And now David, here he is, the one who's actually feared. He's feared by the Philistines. He's feared by Saul. He finds himself afraid. This is a story where he's pursued on all sides, not just by Saul, because Saul has decided in his heart he's going to kill David. So David's on the run. He flees for his life. At the top of Psalm 34, you can actually see this. It writes, of David when he changed his behavior before Abimelech. And that's actually a part of the original text. That's not what somebody wrote in later to remind us, oh yeah, this is when this happened. David wants us to know this. So this is a story that happens in 1 Samuel chapter 21. And it depicts David on the run for his life. And while on the run, David does something really weird. He decides, he leaves Israel, and he decides to go to Gath. What does that mean to us? Gath is the Philistine capital. It's Goliath's hometown. And he's actually on the run with Goliath's sword. I don't know about you, that is not where I'm going if I'm running from Israel. I'm not going to my enemy's capital, who know who I am. It's actually on his hip. David seeks refuge, but he doesn't go to God. What he does is he actually tries to fix his own problems, what most of us do. And what I have done time and time again, so much so, actually over time, I've just denied the fear and anxiety. I'm gonna fix the problems. It's the little problems. I'm gonna do it. And when it started showing up, my anxiety started ratcheting. I started to kind of lose sleep, try to fixate and obsess on fixing whatever problem it was in my house or anything. Until about 4 years ago, I actually started having anxiety manifesting in my body. We were remodeling a house. That went haywire. We had to move in with some of our good friends into their basement. We had an 18-month-old pregnant with an ex on the way, and we were having some difficulties with the pregnancy. So we were worried about our second-born's health. And on top of that, my work was all-consuming, and it was pretty defeating. So I had just ratcheted up all these things. I'm going to try to fix my problems. I'm going to make it work, anything that I can control. Until the day that our second child was born, my anxiety had gotten so great that I started to have abdominal migraines, these severe headaches that manifest themselves in violent stomach pain. And my fear and anxiety actually ratcheted up so much that I can't eat all kinds of foods now. It's affected my daily life in great ways, my family, my faith. Where are you, God? What is going on? I thought I'm doing your work. I'm caring for my family. I'm I'm fixing my own problems. You don't even have to work hard. But fear and anxiety cannot be left undealt with. It cannot be left undealt with. And it's destructive to our lives, as it has been to mine. David is a refugee. He's fleeing for his life. He goes to his, seeking asylum to try to see, oh wait, maybe they'll take me in. Maybe I can fly under the radar. And of course, they recognize him. He's got Goliath's sword on his hip. And so they bring him to their king, and the king is like, isn't this the guy that killed our giant? Isn't this the guy who they're singing songs about all over the region? Even they know about the songs, and it terrifies them. They're like, we're going to kill this guy. And David, at Psalm 20, or 1 Samuel 21, says that in that moment, David is much afraid, or he's terrified. And in a state of terror, he makes a super weird decision, but many of us would do the same. He actually decides to act insane. He goes crazy. He starts scratching the wall and drooling all over the place. He's so convincing that the king of Gath is like, whoa, do we lack madmen? Like, why did you bring this guy to me? Don't we have enough crazy people here? Get him out of here. Get him out of here. And somehow David is able to escape with his life. And he flees to Adullam, this cave, and it becomes a refuge. And in the cave, David comes to the end of himself. He's been seeking to fix his own problems. And finally, this lost refugee finds refuge in the Lord. And 1 Samuel 22 says that all these people came to him. It ends up being about 400 people. It says, everyone who is in distress and everyone who is in debt and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him. And this is when he pens Psalm 34. All over the psalm, David uses words like poor, humble, weak, afflicted, brokenhearted, crushed in spirit. And he identifies with the people that are coming to him. They're feeling the same thing. But he has learned in seeking the Lord something particularly new, and he wants to share it with them. Before we move on to the solution, I think it's important to take a step and to think about when you're afraid, when you're anxious, when you're dealing with stuff from work or anxieties with your coworkers, with your family, what do you actually do? Do you actually take them to the Lord? Or do you binge on old episodes of The Office? You scroll endlessly on your phone. When someone confesses anxiety to you, what do you do? What do you actually do? You kind of justify it like, that's actually scaring me right now. You can stop talking about it. I'm stressed. Or do you pray for them? What do you do with fear? Fear is brutal to us. It leaves us in distress. It robs us of joy. But 1 Peter 5:7, it says, cast all your anxieties on him, all your cares, because he cares for you. And this is what David does, and he calls us to do the same. He learns the solution to his fear. And as we look at Psalm 34, we see the solution to fear is actually very directly connected to the object that we're afraid of. David isn't cowering at this point. He actually isn't grumbling. He isn't holding God in contempt for his situation. He's been righteous and faithful. Shouldn't God have taken care of him thus far? What we see in Psalm 34 is actually that David is in a place of inner thriving amidst his fear, amidst his suffering. But when he was gripped by fear, it crushed him. But seeking the Lord has done something different. God has delivered him from fear into fear. Into fear of the Lord. If you look at the psalm, verses 4 starts with fear. And there's five times in this 22 verses that the English word fear is used. But actually, if you look at the Hebrew, there's two different words being used. In verse 4, when it says, the Lord delivered me from my fears, it uses this word megara, and it means terrors, or the things that one is afraid of, the thing that we dread. But the other four times, when referring to the fear of the Lord, it's using a totally different word. It means awestruck. The word is yare. It means awestruck. It's deeply moved by power. immensity and greatness. We got to live in Colorado for about 4 years, and a couple times I got to go hike 14ers. And if you've ever been in the mountains, or if you've ever been out in the wilderness and underneath the stars with nothing else around, you're just trying to stand in front of it, your knees start to get weak. The glory of it starts to feel like it's actually weighing on you. There's something crazy about it. This is the kind of awe, the glory and the gravity of even in creation. Well, David experiences a greater one, and that's the presence of the Lord. God's presence actually totally dissolves his anxieties, his fear, his threats. The greatest threat on his life is now that he, an imperfect man, is before God, a holy God. And his fears dissolve when he experiences God's greatness. God has delivered him from terrors, from his fear, into awe, into worship. Fear of the Lord primarily has to do with worship. And God is serious about our fear because he's serious about our worship. What or who we fear directs who or where we go in our fear. So the fear of the Lord begins with who we seek. Let's look at verse 1 of Psalm 34. It begins with who we seek, and it turns into continual praise. Verse 1. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name forever together. I sought the Lord. Verse 4. I sought the Lord, and he answered me, and he delivered me from my fears. What we fear in the presence of God changes to who we fear. This is a drastic change in his life. David is experiencing something that's quite life-changing. Not only is God powerful and mighty and holy, he's worthy of being feared, he's terrifying, but David has tasted that in fearing God, he can see the goodness of God at the same time. But like we talked about earlier, isn't this the first thing that comes up? When we deal with fear, when we deal with affliction, the question that we're flooded with, but wait, is God actually good? Well, David actually is so moved by God's goodness that he says in verse 8, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. Have you ever had a meal that was so good that you feel like you needed to like rebuke your friends for eating anything else? I'm so guilty. I do this all the time. Coffee, food, whatever. I have tasted of the nectar of great, delicious, lightly roasted, single origin coffee. And it enriched my life, and it's going to enrich your life, and it's going to change it forever. Right? David has experienced and tasted something so great, he cannot help but invite those around him. He has to invite them into the joy of understanding and knowing and actually experiencing God's goodness. Not just theoretically or theologically saying, yeah, God's good. We've sung about it all today. That God's good. Yeah, sure. Uh-huh. No, but tangibly experiencing that. But we live in a society that actually does not deal with fear at all. And in fact, what we do, having denied it so much, we live in a society that says, God can't be good if I'm fearing, afraid of something, or if I'm experiencing difficult. There's no way that he's good. And in fact, if that's true, there's no way that he's real. There's a sociologist, his name is Christian Smith. He's a Notre Dame professor. And he did all this, tons and tons of research to study what is the most common religion in terms of the practical beliefs in America. What's the most common religion in America? And he actually has come up with a name for it. Moralistic therapeutic deism. This is the most common religion in America. In this religion, there is a God, but his only work is to produce and maintain our happiness, our comfort, and our tranquility. He says this is what 60% of Americans actually believe, particularly millennials. And if he's real, God will intervene in my life, but only to ensure this kind of happiness. As long as we don't offend or harm someone else and their happiness, God's going to be good to me as long as I don't mess with your happiness. You do you. Unlike all ancient religions, this religion has no answer for suffering. Absolutely no answer for death. No answer for our fear. But suffering is a universal experience. When we only trust God to pull us out of our suffering and keep us happy, free, a life free from suffering, then we blame God when he doesn't. We hold him in contempt. How can God be good if I am not happy? When we look at Psalm 34, that's not actually what David's doing at all. David is seeing that suffering is actually not connected to God's goodness. Look at verse 19. David says, many are the afflictions of the righteous. Suffering is connected to living in a world fractured by sin. And fear and anxiety, they play this huge role in that. Fear and anxiety is always about the future, a future pain, a future crisis, a future whatever it is, thing that I owe. Our anxiety is always about the future, a future disappointment. To fear the Lord is to seek refuge in him. And that word refuge actually just means to place your faith in, to put trust in. While fear is about the future, faith is about the present. And faith is about looking past to God's faithfulness, not about the future. Ed Welch actually calls worriers false prophets. Because we're imagining the future without God in it. We can only taste, you can taste today God's goodness. You can't taste tomorrow. Right now, you can't taste tomorrow what meal you're going to have. But today, you actually can taste of his goodness as we look on the faithfulness of Jesus. As we look on God's faithfulness to us in our life. As we look to Christ and what he's done, that is where we can actually taste and see that he's good. Be honest with yourself. Have you tangibly, physically, really experienced God's goodness in your life? Not just theoretically or theologically, we say it, cool, I'm going to maybe believe it. But in your life, have you experienced his goodness? If you look back on your life, has God been faithful to you and good to you? I've heard stories over and over in our church of God actually delivering people. We have a ministry based on seeing God deliver us from addiction. We have seen, many of us have felt this and experienced it. I've experienced it from addiction, self-obsession, justifying myself, living in anxiety. God has delivered us. We've tasted in our life. We're not tasting it now because we're not looking on the ways he's been faithful. Take time today. Think on it. Tell somebody that you love. Tell somebody, oh, I have tasted the goodness of God in my life. In Psalm 34, we see the brokenness of David, but in his brokenness, he actually has met the God who draws near to him. Look at verse 18. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted. That word near or close is actually a relational term. He's relationally close to the brokenhearted. Closer than a brother, closer than a sister. He draws near to us. David has experienced the presence and the nearness of God, and therefore his goodness. He's testifying to the fact that God will not abandon his people in affliction, but rather he enters it. David gives these incredible series of images all throughout the psalm, 4, 5, 6, verse 15 through 18, and it personifies God and his relationship to people, his relational nearness. This is David's primary explanation of God's goodness. David writes in verse 4, I sought, verse 5, I looked to the Lord. Verse 6, he heard me. Verse 15, the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous. His ear is toward their cry. Verse 17, the Lord hears and delivers. There's this incredible Latin term, coram Deo. It means before the face of, or in the favorable presence of God. And this is what David is describing, that we get to live in the favorable presence of God. In our suffering, he draws near to us. After a tragic accident took his son's life, theologian Nicholas Wolterstorff wrote this incredible book called Lament for a Son. And he wrote, God is not only the God of the sufferer, but the God who suffers. What a great mystery to redeem our brokenness. The God who suffers with us did not strike some mighty blow of power, but rather he sent his beloved son to suffer like us, through his suffering to redeem us from suffering. This is incredible. He writes, instead of explaining our suffering, God shares it. And this is the incarnation. Emmanuel, God with us. God doesn't promise to remove all of our difficulty now, but he promises that he himself will be enough for us in it. The fear of the Lord is a life of worship. Seeking the Lord for refuge turns into blessing him at all times, praising him continually, experiencing his splendor, his nearness, and his goodness. We get to taste and see and know our God. The fear of the Lord is the solution to our fears, but we need to talk about how this is made possible. How this is made possible. When we read the story of David, we are tempted to put ourselves in the place of David. We want to speak from his place. Kendall talked about this last week. We are not the protagonist here. It's really easy for us to put ourselves there. We're the fearful Israelites. We're murderously fearful Saul. Look at verse 15. He proclaims himself the righteous. He calls out in verse 9 to the holy ones. In Psalm 34, who we are those who seek refuge in other things. Verse 16, we are those who do evil. 21, we are the wicked. Verse 12, we are those who suffer want and hunger. So how does the fear of the Lord, how does God make that fear actually work for us? Let's get back to those two words of fear. The first one from verse 4 is a word megara. And it's a really rare word in the scriptures. It's only used two other times. And each time that it's used, it's in the context of being abandoned to destruction in your fear. Megara is used to denote punishment by fear, punishment by being overwhelmed and overcome. But when David says in verse 4, I sought the Lord and he answered me, he delivered me from my megara. He means that God has snatched him out of punishment. He saved him out of the destruction of his fear. God has not abandoned him to be destroyed. David has learned that we are going to absolutely be consumed by what we fear. We're going to be overtaken by it. And when we fear the Lord, we are consumed with him. We are overtaken, but not destroyed. Look at verse 21. Affliction will slay the wicked. Verse 19, but the Lord delivers the righteous out of all affliction. So how does David make this jump? He's delivered from punishment into being able to call himself the righteous, calling us the righteous. Well, how does he say that? God has delivered him from destruction, from punishment, into righteousness. And sandwiched between those two verses, between 19 and 21, is an incredible thing. Look at verse 20. And it seems weirdly out of context, but he says, he keeps all his bones. Not one of them will be broken. Not one of them is broken. This is a quote from Exodus. It's referring to the sacrificial lamb. When the angel of death took the lives of the firstborn of every family in Egypt, but those who had killed the lamb, the unblemished lamb, and did not break the legs of it, would be safe from death. And David is saying two things here. David is proclaiming that the people of God, the people who seek God, will find him because he has provided a way through sacrifice for us to know him, for us to be near him. He's provided a way. And the second thing that David is saying is that the blood of the Lamb is what saved Israel from death, from the thing that's at the root of all our fears. Ernest Becker talks about this in his book, The Denial of Death. That what we ultimately are afraid of is death. And that the other fears that we experience are like many deaths in our life. John 19 quotes this exact verse. He quotes this psalm. He describes Jesus whose legs weren't broken on the cross. In crucifixion, as agonizing as the flogging and the beating and the nails that went through one's wrists were and through one's foot, the way that someone actually died in crucifixion was by suffocation. Every time that you needed to breathe, you had to push up on your legs and pull up with your hands to take a breath. And it's absolutely excruciating. Every breath. And so the Roman soldiers would take big clubs and they would break the legs of those on the cross in order to have mercy on them. Because it could take a matter of days over time to die. But this didn't happen to Jesus. In John 19, it describes that Christ's legs weren't broken. They didn't have to break his legs because he laid his life down. He was faithful to the end. He died to defeat death by his death, to redeem our souls and to defeat death forever. The problem of fear is real and it's pervasive, and the pain of death, it's real. When Jesus stood outside of Lazarus's tomb, it said he was deeply moved, which means he was angered by death and he wept. But fear and death, they don't have the last word, and Christ has made that absolutely possible. Jesus has the last word. He has delivered us from punishment of sin into continual praise. He's delivered us from death into everlasting life. This is why at the start of John 1, Jesus says to disciples that are coming out to him, "What are you seeking?" And at the end of John, in John 20, he says to Mary Magdalene, "Who are you seeking?" Jesus is the answer to our fear. And he answers us in our fear. When we fear death, what does Jesus say? He says, "I am the resurrection and the life." When we fear decisions about our future, he says, "I am the good shepherd and I will guide you." When we fear future provision, Jesus says, "I am the bread of life." When we fear loneliness, Jesus says, "I am the true vine. Abide in me." When we fear judgment, Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." We are about to physically taste and see that he's good. And it's not about having a tasty snack in the middle of the day. We actually get to taste his body broken, his blood shed, the real goodness of God poured out for us on our behalf. When we were evil, he poured out his blood. He allowed his body to be given up for us. And we get to taste his deliverance. We taste and see that the one true lion became a lamb for us. And he laid down his life so that we wouldn't be crushed by affliction. But Isaiah 53, he was crushed for our iniquities. This is the goodness of God. Look at verse 22. He summarizes the whole sermon, the whole psalm in this way, in sermon. "The Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who seek refuge in him, who put their faith in him, who trust in him, will be condemned." Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.